Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this Ogletree Deacons Podcast on pre-employment testing. My name is Sarah Kino, and I am a shareholder in our Tampa and St. Louis offices. Joining me today is Ray Gross, a shareholder from our Detroit office. In our practices, we both advise employers on employment testing, including the parameters and legal implications surrounding employment test, which is what we are going to talk about today. We all know that for many employers, hiring new employees can be time-consuming, costly, and stressful. Finding the right candidates to join your workforce can have many beneficial consequences, ranging from a dedicated workforce and satisfied customers to increased profitability. By the same token, the wrong hiring decisions can have significant negative impacts, such as high turnover, low productivity, unproductive or disgruntled employees, higher workplace injury rates, and unnecessary litigation risks. And that names just some, but by no means all of the predominant issues. As a result, companies are increasingly turning to a variety of pre-employment tests and assessments as a means of taking some of the guesswork out of the hiring process, which also mitigates the risks of bad hiring decisions. Pre-employment testing is a multi-million dollar a year industry, and it is growing every day. There are a wide variety of tests and hundreds of vendors out there, along with a whole vocabulary of sometimes confusing buzzwords that we're going to go over today, like validity, adverse impact, and uniform guidelines. Today, we will also spend some time talking about pre-employment testing in general and the types of tests, how and why employers use them, the legal issues relating to the testing, and some basic concepts of adverse impact and test validation. Ray, since you have a wealth of experience in this area, can you explain what types of tests you typically see employers using or contemplate using?
Sure, I'd be happy to. As you mentioned, Sarah, there are a wide variety of tests and pre-employment assessments out there on the marketplace. Which one any given employer is going to choose to use will depend in large part on what type of job is being filled and what objectives the employer has and what they want to accomplish with their testing program. One of the most common forms of tests that's been around and been used by employers for years is what's commonly called a cognitive or an aptitude test. Cognitive tests are the kind of tests that measure an applicant's reasoning and their problem solving and other kind of learning skills. It would be sort of similar to the kind of tests that you're used to having taken in school. These types of tests usually use basic math problems, reading comprehension questions, and sometimes logic problems to assess a candidate's reading and verbal and mathematical or reasoning skills. They can measure a candidate's basic knowledge and their ability to apply that knowledge and logic and how quickly they learn. These type of tests are used to measure cognitive abilities that are basic requirements for a variety of different jobs. And as an example, they're frequently used for entry-level technical or industrial-type jobs that require a certain level of reading comprehension and basic math skills or computation skills, things that would require an applicant to follow sort of standard operating procedures or perhaps calibrate equipment or just be able to read and follow critical safety instructions or manufacturing protocols. More sophisticated versions of these kind of cognitive tests can measure higher levels of mathematical or statistical ability. These kind of tests are used for analytical jobs. Jobs might require a higher level of, for example, financial analysis. Another variation of a cognitive test is a test that will actually mimic the actual tasks that the employer will have to perform on the job. Those would be things like if you're hiring someone to do a job that requires Excel skills, you might actually give them a data set and ask them to generate an analysis or use a pivot table to show their Excel abilities. The second type of test that's frequently used now and is an ever-growing type of market is what's called a personality or a behavioral assessment. This is another increasingly popular form of pre-employment test. These tests typically use a combination of sort of self-choice, self-rated options. You're asked, an applicant would be asked a series of questions and be asked to either agree or disagree or rate how much they agree on a scale of, say, 1 to 5 with statements like, I have an analytical mind, or I work well with others, or sometimes I make mistakes. Typically, applicants who are taking these tests don't always see the connection between the questions and the job. It's not always obvious. But these kind of tests are designed to measure your attitudes, beliefs, traits that might be relevant to successful performance in a particular job or field. For example, if you're hiring sales people, you might be using a personality or a behavioral assessment that might measure someone's self-motivation or their assertiveness or their self-confidence. Whereas if you're hiring customer service people, you might be looking more for people who are demonstrating a high degree of patience or a relaxed, cooperative attitude, perhaps a desire to help others. Similarly, if you're hiring for, you know, a security type position or perhaps home health care, something that requires conscientiousness, you might be testing for integrity and honesty and whether or not a person has a tendency to follow the rules. The third and also widely used form of pre-employment tests is what's called a physical abilities test. And Sarah, I know you've had a lot of experience working with these kind of tests. What kind of unique issues do you think physical abilities tests pose?
I would be happy to talk about that. Physical tests can be deceptively challenging because it might seem like a basic strength test is a sure way to screen applicants for their ability or inability to complete the required tasks of a job. But without careful analysis, these tests can lead to legal issues. And one of those legal issues concerns when employers administer the test to potential hires in relation to hiring or offering employment. Specifically, whether the test is pre-offer or post-offer, because there are different rules or requirements surrounding what we can do pre versus post-offer as an employer. Pre-offer, it is permissible to give tests that simulate job tasks, such as tests that require candidates to perform tasks in a timed course that replicate simulations of the job. We often see this when applicants need to lift or carry heavy items or use equipment that is difficult to manage if they have to climb or navigate in confined spaces. But as we will discuss shortly, such simulations need to match the actual requirements of the job, which can be tough to implement in practice. Employers at the pre-offer stage can also conduct general agility or stamina tests. Examples include equipment that measures lift or muscle strength, or things like timed runs. Again, a frequent disadvantage of this type of test is that it does not mimic the job task closely enough. In other words, these tests can be an indirect measure of a candidate's general physical ability to perform the essential functions of a job. As a result, and as Ray will elaborate on, it is vulnerable to be challenged that on the basis that it is not clearly job-related. Another legal issue that arises is under the ADA, or the Americans with Disabilities Act, which regulates the type of tests that are allowed on a pre-offer basis. Specifically, at the pre-offer stage, we cannot do medical examinations. As you can imagine, what constitutes a medical exam can be tricky in a physical ability test. For example, a test that measures heart rate or blood pressure while lifting, carrying, or climbing can become a medical test that is impermissible pre-hire. Another hurdle in medical tests surrounds using the medical information we learn from the test or how we use it. The ADA limits the use of such information and we need to limit it to determining whether the applicant can perform the essential functions of the job. The ADA also limits dissemination of the information we learn, and we want to limit it to only those people with a need to know the information, and we want to make sure we're keeping the information confidential. Practically, once an employer learns the medical information, it cannot unlearn it. So this can potentially increase the risk of an ADA claim.
So Sarah, it sounds like the ADA and medical issues are a big concern when you're dealing with physical ability tests. Does the ADA come into play with other types of tests?
Absolutely. Under the ADA, an employer has an obligation to provide reasonable accommodations during pre-employment testing when applicable. So even in the non-physical setting, if we have, say, a cognitive test that you discussed earlier, some applicants might need additional time. They might need a reader. They might need adaptive computer equipment if they have a physical impairment, such as a vision limitation. In addition, the ADA requires that any test must be job-related and consistent with business necessity, and that includes physical ability tests. Physical test has a level that exceeds the job, meaning if the lifting requirements are heavier than what the applicant has to do on the job, that can lead to legal liability issues, and especially if it has an adverse or a disparate impact. Disparate and adverse impacts is not limited to just physical tests. It can also be a potential issue with all pre-employment tests. Isn't that right, Ray?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It sort of is at the center of most employment litigation. So just by way of background, all pre-employment testing has to comply with the basic prohibitions on discrimination that are in Title VII and the Age Discrimination Employment Act and similar state laws. What that means in practice is that a testing program cannot exclude individuals based on protected categories such as their race or gender or age. As many of our listeners may already be aware, there are two general categories of discrimination: disparate treatment and disparate impact. Disparate treatment is what's known as intentional discrimination, and that tends to rarely be an issue in testing cases. An example of disparate treatment in a testing case would be, for example, giving a physical ability test only to female candidates. That's intentional discrimination. Disparate impact, on the other hand, is when a neutral test that's given to everybody has the effect of disproportionately excluding persons of a particular protected category, such as a race or gender or age. Determining whether a test or a selection procedure has a disparate impact on a particular group ordinarily requires a statistical analysis, and that analysis will show you if the test is disproportionately screening out applicants based on their race or gender. So using your physical test as an example, if you give a physical abilities test to 100 men and 100 women, 80 of the men pass, but only 40 of the women do, that test is having a disparate impact on female applicants. Now, that may or may not mean that use of the test is unlawful. If a test has a disparate impact, it may be lawfully used, but the employer has to be able to show that the test is what's called job-related and consistent with business necessity. That's kind of a buzzword in the testing world. And that means that an employer has to be able to show that the test is necessary to the safe or efficient operation and performance of the job, or that the test is accurately measuring the essential skills that are needed to perform the job successfully. Demonstrating that a test is job-related and consistent with business necessity is no easy task, though. It usually requires technical assistance from a professional testing expert. Now, we also get some guidance from the government. And Sarah, is there any particular place where employers can look for guidance from the government in terms of what's required to demonstrate the job-relatedness of a test?
In fact, there is. The EEOC has adopted the Uniform Guidelines on Employee Selection Procedures, and that is abbreviated typically as the Uniform Guidelines, or UGESP. And in the UGESP, there's a definition of adverse impact. And as Ray discussed, that is if a substantially different rate of selection in hiring, promotion, or other employment decision works to the disadvantage of members of a particular race, sex, or ethnic group, there's going to be a presumption of an adverse impact. That does not mean, however, that we can't use these tests or that we have to alter the essential functions of a position if there is an adverse impact. What we need to be aware of is if there is a substantially different selection rate, an employer can either eliminate the use of the test or procedure or alter it so that there is no longer an adverse impact. Or, as Ray said, we can demonstrate that the procedure is business related and that no less discriminatory alternative exists. And the last portion of that is a really challenging hurdle for employers in many cases, that no less discriminatory alternative exists. And that's often an area where the EEOC focuses on other employers to show that, in fact, there are less discriminatory alternatives. The UGESP addresses validation procedures that employers can use to demonstrate that a test is job-related and consistent with business necessity. These methods of demonstrated job-relatedness are called test validation. And that's another one of the buzzwords in the testing world in the pre-employment and employment context. UGESP provide detailed guidance about each method of test validation. We don't have time to cover all of the ins and outs of test validation today, but Ray, can you give us some of the basics?
Sure, absolutely. And I mean, as you said, this gets very complicated, so it really requires a broad discussion. But in simple terms, test validation begins almost always with a job analysis. So if you're using a particular kind of test for a particular job or a range of jobs, you want to make sure that you have used the assistance of some sort of expert. It could be an ergonomics expert if it's a physical test, or it could be an industrial organizational psychologist if it's a personality test. But whatever expertise you need, you want to use that person to analyze the jobs and identify the key functions and skills that are necessary to perform the jobs for which you want to put in a testing program. The uniform guidelines then talk about the different ways that you can validate a test. The first and most common form of validation is what's called content validity. Content validity is pretty much just what it sounds like. It's basically a systematic way of showing that the content of the test is directly connected to the content of the job. And it usually requires, so going back, for example, to the technician jobs that I talked about earlier, that would mean that someone would come in and do a job analysis of the employer's jobs, determine what level of math and reading comprehension might be required for an entry-level technician, design a test that would be designed to measure that level of reading and math comprehension, and then apply that test to the workforce to determine whether or not it does really match the content of the job. So a test of basic mathematical ability might be totally appropriate for an entry-level technician, probably less appropriate for somebody who is, you know, a food service employee or a factory worker that does basic, you know, work that doesn't require any sort of mathematical comprehension or any reading comprehension skills. The second and also fairly common means of validation is something that's called criterion-related validity. Criterion is a little bit more complicated because that more than just showing that the test is similar to the job, criterion validation actually involves a statistical study that's designed to demonstrate the relationship between performance on the test and performance on the job. So essentially, it requires doing that job analysis, which is always step number one, and then creating a test that is designed to demonstrate that either the basic skills or the personality traits or whatever it is that you are testing for on the test are substantially similar to what's required for successful performance on the job. So if you do a criterion validation, the end result of that is you're able to show pretty much on a graph that people who score higher on the test will tend to perform better on the job. Now, how you measure that performance can vary. You can measure it based on performance ratings or sales or turnover or safety, whatever it is that the employer is really trying to get at in terms of measuring accurate performance. Criterion validation does, though, tend to be very costly. It's time-consuming because it requires having a pretty large sample size and collecting all that data and correlating the test scores to the performance. It's probably the most valuable form of validation, but it can be time-consuming and expensive. So oftentimes what we see is a technique, what's called validity generalization. That's another approach to validity that's based on essentially using existing criterion studies from other industries to show that the results of those industries can be transported or borrowed and applied to your workforce on the basis of a job study that shows a substantial similarity between the tasks that are required on your jobs and those that have been done with the other criterion studies. A lot of vendors will use validity generalization as a means by which to validate tests for employers. It's a valid technique, but it's less commonly accepted, at least by the EEOC and the OFCCP. So it's one that we suggest that employers at least be mindful of in terms of making sure they understand what is being done by their vendor before they accept that as a validation of the test. And along those lines, you know, things that employers might want to consider doing if they're implementing or changing their pre-employment testing program would be, you know, be cautious about off-the-shelf, inexpensive assessments that have broad assurances that they're valid. Just because a vendor's website says that a test is valid doesn't necessarily mean that it's been validated for the jobs and for the purpose that you want it for. So if you're contemplating entering into a contract for a test or an assessment with a vendor, some questions that employers might want to think about discussing with their vendors would be, you know, actually ask to see what their validation evidence looks like. If you get an EEOC charge or an OFCCP audit, and which, by the way, means that you do work with the federal government, so you're subject to the jurisdiction of the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, and they will typically frequently audit testing programs as part of their regular protocol. So if you anticipate that you could get any activity like that, you might want to talk to your vendor about whether or not they've had experience with any EEOC charges or audits, whether their test has been the subject of any litigation, and ask to see, you know, whether or not they can show if their test does or doesn't have adverse impact. Are they keeping that kind of data? Can they give you any historical information about that? You might want to ask about what litigation or audit support that they would provide you if you do, in fact, get some sort of a claim. You know, testing vendors typically have a stake in this, too. They certainly don't want their test to be one that's deemed discriminatory. So you want to ask them whether or not they would be able to provide any sort of expertise to assist you if you got an EEOC charge or something like that. Also, you might want to just find out how your return on investment is going to be measured. I mean, how are you going to determine whether or not the investment that you put into the test is really yielding you results? Are you going to measure retention, productivity, quality, safety, some combination of all of those things? These are all kinds of issues that employers might want to think about discussing with potential testing vendors before you launch into some testing program. Now, Sarah, once employers actually have a testing program in place, are there any considerations that they need to think about going on a forward basis?
Absolutely. So on a going forward basis, it's important to continue monitoring whether these tests have an adverse impact or whether they develop an adverse impact later in the process than when we implemented. And we will want to work with our testing vendor to explore ways to assess whether there is an adverse impact and whether there's a way to administer the test with less of an adverse impact. And I've actually had clients that chart this and figure out in the physical ability setting who is passing from a male-female standpoint, from an age standpoint, and if there are industries with race or other issues in cognitive tests that are on the EEOC's radar, it's maybe not a bad idea to track that information if it is available. We also want to update the validation if the job happens to change, because oftentimes we all know that job requirements are fluid, and it could be that lifting requirements or other cognitive abilities are an aspect of the job upon hire, but later in the process, the job changes. And we just want to make sure that our test still matches the actual job duties. Another big thing to be aware of is having a clear process in place for accommodating disabilities at the testing phase. This issue can often fall through the cracks if we're using a standardized web-based test, for example, or if we have a third-party administrator for the test. It is a good idea for that reason to spell out whose responsibility it is to take and respond to those accommodation requests. And we've actually helped clients draft those type of policies. And with that, we are going to wrap up. We appreciate everyone joining us today.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.